This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Our speaker tonight, Rabbi Laura Geller, was one of the very first women anywhere ordained as a rabbi. Her first position as a rabbi was as the Hillel rabbi at USC, the University of Southern California. That's where I met her. And she was early on recognized as one of the leading forces in the Hillel movement. While she was at USC, she was the co-organizer of an award-winning conference, and this is just one of many, many accomplishments during those years at USC, but she was the co-organizer of an award-winning conference entitled Illuminating the Unwritten Scroll, Women's Spirituality and Tradition. And then in 1990, Rabbi Geller was the first woman to be named the senior rabbi of a synagogue in a major metropolitan city. I want to try to emphasize, you know, every word of that description, because it's one thing for a small congregation. It's not a small thing, but it's one thing for a Hillel or a small congregation to name a woman as their rabbi, or for a large synagogue to name a woman as an assistant rabbi. It is a completely different thing for a major synagogue in a major metropolitan area to name a woman as the senior rabbi, and Rabbi Laura Geller was the first to break that glass ceiling. The stained glass ceiling. I hadn't heard that expression, but And as you can imagine, you know, it takes enormous courage both for the congregation to make a decision like that and also for the individual rabbi to take that on, to be the first, to be the pioneer in that role. She's been doing that since 1990, and in the way that she has provided leadership for Temple Emmanuel of Beverly Hills, she has really paved the way for women rabbis all over the country and now really around the world. Once I became a Hillel rabbi myself here at UCSB, Rabbi Geller and I were colleagues, and I deeply, deeply cherished at the time and continue to this day to cherish my friendship with her. We worked together on many projects and studied together, and I have always seen Rabbi Geller as one of the most courageous, supremely intelligent, often brutally honest, no matter who she's talking to, always ethical and warm and funny. In my book, that pretty much makes the complete rabbi. And so I'm very honored to introduce to you my friend and teacher, Rabbi Laura Geller.
What Rabbi Cohen did not say is that you say the blessing of the sun at sunrise, and so there are no USC students anywhere to be seen. So the title for my talk is Nice Jewish Girls, Radicals, Activists, and Rabbis. It's a pretty good title, don't you think? I owe it to my friend, the very talented rabbi of this congregation, how lucky you are to have Rabbi Steve Cohen as your rabbi. He was my chevruta partner for many years when I was at USC and he was at UCSB. That means we studied together, sometimes face-to-face, sometimes over the phone, always over text, sharing not only the Torah of tradition, but also the Torah of our own lives. So thanks for the title. But in the light of the tragedy that devastated not only this community, but all of America, I think I would want to give it a slightly different title. I'd like to call it Making the World Safe for Women. It's not over yet. And then I'd give it the subtitle, What Can We Learn from Our Jewish Foremothers About This? So one thing we learn, again, is the need for serious gun control. I'm reminded that in 1993, in response to the gun industry's expansive marketing campaign toward women, some nice Jewish girls, including then Los Angeles Police Commissioner Anne Rice Lane and Betty Friedan, coordinated a national conference that articulated guns and gun violence as a women's issue. The sponsoring organization at the time was the American Jewish Congress, where I was the executive director. And out of this conference, Women Against Gun Violence was born. The founding innovative idea of taking on gun violence as a women's issue couldn't be more relevant today. So it's tempting to say that Elliot Rodger was just a sad, deranged individual, and that was most likely true. But apparently his craziness was nourished by a misogynistic movement that views women as less than full persons. The men's rights movement, of which he was a part, teaches its members that women, and especially feminist women, are to be blamed for their unhappiness, and therefore women deserve some kind of punishment. Now, most of the time, I, like many of you, feel that we've come such a long way. But then there are moments, and tragically, this is one of those moments, when we realize that there's still so much work to do to make real the essential Jewish teaching that all human beings, male and female, are created in the image of God. We learn that first from the first chapter of Genesis. We learn it again from the first century rabbinic sage Ben Azai, who argued that this notion, all human beings are created in the image of God, male and female, is the fundamental principle of Torah. Everything else is commentary for him. That is the essential teaching. And we also learn that from those women in our history upon whose shoulders we stand. Years ago, I came to understand that all theology is autobiography. So I'll begin with where the story starts for me, from women wanting to be rabbis. The history of women aspiring to be rabbis didn't begin with Rabbi Sally Prezant. In fact, the very first woman to be ordained a rabbi, whose story we know at least, is a woman named Regina Jonas, a German woman who was ordained in 1935 in Berlin and murdered in Auschwitz. But her story is for another discussion, because my focus tonight is on women in America. Since the 1890s, the question of women's ordination was raised in the Anglo-Jewish press and in certain Jewish organizations. In 1889, there was a journalist named Mary Cohen who broached the topic of women rabbis in an article that appeared on the front page of the Jewish Exponent, a newspaper. Then in 1890, Ray Frank, who was a Jewish school principal, learned that there were not going to be any high holiday services in Spokane, Washington. So she agreed to preach there. This was 1890. From then until shortly before her marriage a decade later, she preached and led religious services, studied for a time at the Hebrew Union College, the Reform Seminary, and wrote about what she would do if she were a rabbi, even though she said she didn't want to be one. It was again an issue in 1903 when Henrietta Zold, the foremost Jewish woman of her day, went to meet with the Jewish Theological Seminary president, Solomon Schechter, about studying there. She later wrote about that encounter. After he was assured that I was not aspiring after rabbinical honors, he agreed to put no obstacles in my way. In the 1920s, following the 19th Amendment's granting women the right to vote, and the heightened expectation that now all barriers to women's full equality would fall, a small number of women did enter rabbinical school with the intention to become rabbis. The first was a woman named Martha Newmark. In 1921, she was 17 years old. She came to the Hebrew Union College, and she launched a 2-year debate over whether or not the college would ordain women rabbis. This is 1921. In the course of that debate, Reform rabbis affirmed in principle that, and now I'm quoting, women cannot justly be denied the privilege of ordination. But the college's board of governors, fearing that this would create an irrevocable break with more traditional sectors of American Jewry, said no. Other women followed, including Helen Leventhal. In 1939, a student at the Hebrew Union College, this Helen Leventhal, received her Master's of Hebrew Literature, but not rabbinic ordination. By then, she had completed the entire rabbinical curriculum and had written a thesis on women's suffrage from the point of view of Jewish law. But eventually she, like many other pioneers before and after her, settled down to a life as a wife, mother, and exemplary Jewish volunteer. So it seems like women could do many things in American Judaism, but they couldn't become rabbis. That all changed in 1972, the year that Rabbi Prezant was ordained. 1972. Try to remember where you were in 1972. For some of us, it was a long time ago, but it doesn't feel that long ago, actually. It was just 9 years after The Feminine Mystique had been published. That was 1963. The feminist movement was beginning to help women discover their own voices and to raise questions about equality between men and women. Remember, 1970s, the critical issues of the day focused on equal pay for equal work, and also the ability of women to enter professional schools that had previously restricted the number of women who could be admitted. Early 70s, questions about equality were emerging in the Jewish world as well. In 1971, a student magazine called Dafka published the now classic article by Rachel Adler called "The Jew Who Wasn't There: Halacha and the Jewish Woman." It was the first time that anyone had looked at the question of Jewish law from a feminist perspective. That perspective empowered a group of women who called themselves Ezrat Nashim, from the section of a synagogue where women used to sit, but actually means the helper of women. This group challenged the conservative movement in 1972 to begin to count women in a minyan, a huge change in Jewish law. Their success eventually led to new kinds of questions, no longer just about the equality of women, but also about the experience of women as religiously engaged Jews. So I was ordained in 1976, the third woman in the Reform movement. I had been the only woman in my class. There were as yet no women professors teaching rabbinics. One day, when my Talmud class was studying Tractate Brachot, I discovered the tradition that a Jew is supposed to say 100 blessings a day. That was new to me. My teacher explained, God is present at every moment in our lives. And we make that presence real through saying blessings. And then he said, there is no important moment in the lifetime of a Jew for which there is no blessing. Suddenly I realized that that wasn't true. There had been important moments in my life for which there was no blessing. So there I am, sitting in this rabbinical school class on West 68th Street in New York City, me and a bunch of really lovely male students, all of whom were my friends. And suddenly I remembered something that I had long forgotten. I remembered being a 13-year-old girl reporting to my mother that I had just got my period. And then hearing my mother say to me, when I got my period, my mother slapped me. She didn't know why. We could talk about that after. Just that it was a tradition. I began to wonder then, what if my mother and I had prepared for that moment in a spiritual way? What if we had celebrated it together by saying a blessing? What if we said, thank you, God, for making me a woman? Or the Shehecheyanu, thank you, God, for keeping us in life and bringing us to this sacred moment. What impact would that have had on my sense of myself as a woman and as a Jew? And what would Judaism look like if what my teacher taught were really true? That there were no important moments in the lifetime of any Jew for which there was no blessing. How would Judaism be different if women's experience was truly celebrated as Jewish experience? So years later, this is why it's sort of good to be a pioneer, because years later, Rachel Adler, famous theologian, reflected on that story in her book, Engendering Judaism. And here's what she says about it. Geller's story depicts a paradoxical situation. She appears to be a full participant in an egalitarian Judaism. She's even a rabbinical student. But her internal experience is of exclusion. Vital dimensions of her personality have been ignored. What is more, her invisibility is invisible. Her teacher and classmates do not know that they do not see her. Geller's story suggests that egalitarian Judaism may integrate women as participants by ignoring their distinctive experience and concerns as women. So another similar moment occurred when my class studied the Talmudic Sugya section that describes intercourse with a little girl as, I'm quoting now, nothing. It is only as if one puts a finger in the eye. While I understood that the rabbis were trying to protect the girl by asserting that she was really still a virgin, and therefore the rape wouldn't affect her bride price, to me, this was a text of terror. No one, neither my male classmates nor my male professor, understood how painful this text was for me. How could the rape of a little girl be nothing? To me, it was very personal. I was once a little girl. A year before my ordination, in 1975, the Reform Movement published its new prayer book, Gates of Prayer. Some of you remember it. The introduction contained an important statement. It said, "We have been keenly aware of the changing status of women in our society. Our commitment in the reform movement to the equality of the sexes is longstanding. In this prayer book, it takes the form of avoiding the use of masculine terminology exclusively when referring to the human race in general." In other words, it was a radical idea in those days that women were actually part of the Jewish community, to say God of our ancestors instead of God of our fathers was huge. We all know that it took years for consciousness to evolve, that we need also to change the way we speak about God, to liberate us from the gendered metaphors of God as exclusively Father and King. And until we can imagine a divinity that transcends gender, it's hard to speak about women and men as truly equal, each created in the image of God. In 1979, when there were still only a handful of women rabbis in the Reform movement, and none yet in the conservative movement, that didn't happen until 1985, the rabbis' convention was scheduled to take place in Arizona, a state that had not supported the Equal Rights Amendment. Remember, the proposed amendment designed to guarantee equal rights for women. 1979, there are six or seven of us. It felt important to us women rabbis to be at the convention, but we wanted to honor the boycott of non-ERA states. I didn't know what to do, so I picked up the phone and called Betty Friedan, who miraculously took my call. Her advice was very clear: go to the convention and invite me to speak. So we did. And that speech was the first time that Betty Friedan made a public connection between her feminism and her Judaism. She began her remarks to the convention. "Sometimes," this is Betty speaking, "sometimes history books say that the modern women's movement began with my book, The Feminine Mystique. Many people have asked me, what made me do it? Probably the simplest answer is that my whole life made me do it. Or that I grew up as a Jewish girl in Peoria, Illinois. I grew up isolated and feeling the injustice, the burning injustice of the subtle and not so subtle anti-Semitism that was the experience of my generation. Girls and boys grew up in towns like Peoria, where we were very largely isolated, and there was the injustice, the irrationality of being barred from sororities, fraternities, and all the other things like country clubs that you were barred from as Jews. I think that this passion that I have had all my life must have come from that. I had this burning feeling, all that I am, I will not deny. It's the core of me. I had this feeling as a Jew first. First as a Jew, before I had it as a woman. All that I am, I will not deny. And if I've had strength and passion, and if that somehow has helped a little bit to change the world or the possibilities of the world, it comes from that core of me as a Jew. My passion, my strength, my creativity, if you will, comes from this kind of affirmation." She goes on. "All the visions of the world, all the passions of injustice, all the things that had been part of me, that I think, therefore I am, that was also true of me. You can see why so many Jewish women particularly gave their souls to feminism. When you think of all those girls brought up by the book, brought up to the book, to the worship of the word, as our brothers were, when you think of all the passion and energy of our immigrant grandmothers in the sweatshops without knowing the language, when you think of mothers rearing sons to be doctors and coping with all the realities of life, when you think of all that passion, all that strength, all that energy, suddenly to be concentrated in one small apartment, one small house, as happened with Portnoy's mother. A lot of women realized that they were not alone, and we broke through the feminine mystique. A lot of women began to say, "All that I am, I will not deny." And I always thought that the unique aspect of the women's movement, which is what made it change things so rapidly, comes from the unique experience of women. But later, as my children, my own son and my spiritual daughters, some of whom are here, began to educate me on Jewish theology, I discovered that it is also profoundly Jewish. Someone once said to me, "The essence of Jewishness is not just holy words and some secret pact with God or some ritual, but it's actions, deeds in society." I guess I'm very Jewish, because that was my whole legacy to the women's movement, that we take actions, not words, to break through the barriers that keep us from participating. 1979. Betty was very Jewish in that way. And she was standing on the shoulders of courageous women who had come before her. Some of the names of those women you probably know. Rebecca Gratz, who founded the first Hebrew Benevolent Society in Philadelphia in 1819. Hannah Greenberg Solomon, born in 1858, active in many Jewish and secular organizations, including the exclusive Chicago Women's Club, where in 1876, Hannah and her sister became the first Jewish members. In 1893, when Chicago was host to the World's Fair, a Jewish Congress was being planned in connection to the World's Fair. And Hannah, who at this point was a leading figure in Chicago's Jewish communal life, became frustrated by men's attempt to exclude women from the planning process. Her frustration led to the creation of the National Council of Jewish Women. During the closing address of the inaugural meeting of the National Council of Jewish Women in 1896, she said, "Who is this new woman who has become such an old subject? She's the woman who dares to go out into the world and do what her convictions demand. And she's the woman who stays home in the smallest, narrowest circle, foregoing all that the world may offer if therein her duty lies. But some of us are taken out upon the hillside and into the open fields where we have a wide perspective and where, if we have clear vision, we see many things that call for our sympathy and help. And I hope that when the call comes to any of us, if we can go, it will find us ready." National Council of Jewish Women grew from 93 founding members in 1893 to over 4,000 members just 3 years later when it held its first convention. And all of you know it has become one of the most important voices in the United States for women's empowerment, for reproductive rights, the end of domestic violence, women's health, and LGBTQ rights. And then, of course, there was Henrietta Szold. I mentioned her before. After visiting Palestine in 1909, she was determined to introduce modern medicine and hygiene there. She transformed her literary Zionist women's society, which was called the Hadassah Circle, into Hadassah, beginning in 1912. We all know the powerful impact that Hadassah has had both in Israel and on Jewish women's empowerment here in the United States. The Jewish Women's Archives, I'll say more about that in a moment, says about her, "Even beyond the enduring contributions of Hadassah, Henrietta Szold's life and career proved both a model and a catalyst for transforming and redefining possibilities for women in Jewish communal life. So I would add to that description, in Jewish religious life as well. Her famous letter to Chaim Peretz, which was written in 1916, has given me courage over the years of my own career. Peretz was a friend who offered to say Kaddish for her mother because traditional Judaism didn't permit daughters to say Kaddish. So here's the letter that she writes. It is impossible for me to find words in which to tell you how deeply I was touched by your offer to act as Kaddish for my mother. I cannot even thank you. It's something that goes beyond thanks. It's beautiful what you've offered to do. I shall never forget it. You will wonder then that I cannot accept your offer. I know well and appreciate what you say about the Jewish custom, and Jewish custom is very dear and sacred to me, and yet I cannot ask you to say Kaddish for my mother. The Kaddish means to me that the survivor publicly and markedly manifests his wish and intention to assume the relationship to the Jewish community which his parent had, and that the chain of tradition remains unbroken from generation to generation, each adding its own link. You can do that for the generations of your family. I must do that for the generations of mine. She goes on. My mother had 8 daughters and no son, and yet never did I hear a word of regret pass the lips of either my mother or father that none of us was a son. When my father died, my mother would not permit others to take her daughter's place in saying Kaddish, and so I am sure I am acting in her spirit when I move to decline your offer. But beautiful your offer remains nevertheless. You understand me, don't you? In 1913, the Reform Movement established the its national sisterhood. The Conservative Movement followed in 1918. In 1921, the National Federation of Temple Sisterhoods, the Reform Sisterhoods, began to lobby for the ordination of women. No woman rabbi would stand here without the support and the energy of the National Foundation, the National Federation of Temple Sisterhoods. So you all know that Jewish women were important not only in the religious realm, but in the secular world as well. Many of the immigrants from Russia and Eastern Europe were women. In fact, in 1910, Jewish women outnumbered Jewish men in New York City. They were an integral part of the workforce, working in factories and small retail mom-and-pop stores, as well as full responsibility for the home and family. We all know about the Triangle Shirtwaist factory fire, 2011. It reminds us of the role that Jewish women played and the price they paid in changing working conditions in America and in the building of the labor movement. That fire, which killed over 140 workers, most of them Jewish and Italian young women immigrants, focused national consciousness on working conditions and eventually led to significant changes in American labor practice. And that influenced the consciousness of Jewish women like me and many of you. I heard the story from my grandparents. I'm sure you heard it from yours. And it helped shape my vision of social justice and maybe even the sense that women can change the world. Betty Friedan, Gloria Steinem, Bella Abzug, and the others of that generation are often described as the second wave of feminism. The first was the struggle for women's suffrage, in which Jewish women were centrally involved, including Gloria Steinem's paternal grandmother. Steinem writes, "What's a nice girl like me doing in a movement like this? I guess the real question is why it took me so long. I was about 34 or 35 before the light began to dawn. I had identified with every other social justice movement in the world first. I think that often happens to women. We identify with other underdogs, even if we don't know why. But there was no women's movement out there, really, and nothing told me to take females as a group seriously. That's especially ironic because I had a Jewish suffragette grandmother, Pauline Perlmutter Steinem, who died when I was about 5. She had addressed Congress, but nobody told me about that. They told me that she was a wonderful woman who kept a kosher table, had 4 sons, and was a pioneer of vocational education. Different measures of success, but not that she was also the first woman to be elected to a board of education in the state of Ohio, as a suffragist on the same ticket with socialists and anarchists. I didn't know this until a feminist historian in Toledo wrote a monograph about her. In a way, feminism rediscovered my grandmother for me. I think a lot of us have women in our families who aren't talked about. They were the feminists. They were the feminists. Women like Lillian Wald, Gertrude Weil, Rosika Schwimmer, Belle Weinstein, Maud Nathan, Rosalie Whitney, and Mary Bell Grossman. Just pick out one. Grossman's involvement in Cleveland's suffragette movement launched her political career as an activist. She later served as a judge, leading the Cleveland Press in 1947 to describe her as a militant feminist who is bad news to wife beaters, gamblers, and persons charged with moral offenses. And Anita Politzer, who demonstrated her commitment to women's suffrage in 1917 by being arrested as a silent sentinel picketing the Woodrow Wilson White House. In August 1920, she used her considerable charm to convince legislator Henry T. Byrne of Tennessee to cast the deciding vote for the Women's Suffrage Amendment. I mention all these names because these women, many of them, have been written out of history, at least until recently. We should all be very grateful to the Jewish Women's Archives, JWA.org, founded in 1995 and devoted to making known the stories, the struggles, and the achievements of Jewish women in North America, in order to enrich the way we understand the past and to ensure a more inclusive future. Nice Jewish girls. Another of those nice Jewish girls was Judith Kaplan, who at age 12 in 1922 was the first woman we know of to become bat mitzvah. Judith was the oldest daughter of Rabbi Mordechai Kaplan, the founder of Reconstructionist Judaism. He believed that girls should have the same religious opportunities as their brothers. So he arranged for his daughter to read Torah on a Shabbat morning at his synagogue, the Society for the Advancement of Judaism. She didn't read Torah from a Torah scroll. Instead, she read a passage in Hebrew and in English from a printed chumash after the regular Torah service. She wrote, "No thunder sounded, no lightning struck." By 1948, about a third of conservative congregations had conducted benot mitzvah ceremonies. By the 1960s, they were a regular feature of conservative congregational life. And today, we all know it's mainstream in all kinds of synagogues across the spectrum. So, of the women in this congregation, how many of you had benot mitzvah when you were girls, little girls? So look around. Not very many. In 1963, when I was 13, my parents gave me a choice. I could have a bat mitzvah, or I could wait and have a sweet 16 party. They didn't give my brothers a choice. So even then, there were still differences in the way families viewed their daughter's connection to Jewish tradition and ceremony. So remember that time. It's sort of hard to remember when so many of the millennial generation has grown up with women rabbis. Here at your congregation, there have been two, yes? It's hard to remember all the barriers when we know now that there are Orthodox women who are functioning as rabbis with pioneer Sarah Horowitz. She's not called rabbi, she's called Maharat, which means spiritual and Jewish legal guide. But she's functioning as a rabbi nonetheless. She was ordained by two very brave rabbis, Rabbi Avi Weiss and Rabbi Daniel Sperber. She is now the dean of Yeshivat Maharat, whose mission is to confirm Orthodox women as halachic and spiritual leaders. And she's part of Jaffa, founded in 1997, the Jewish organization, Jewish Orthodox Feminist Association, which has grown from a small group that once gathered around Blue Greenberg's kitchen table into a professionally staffed international alliance of over 5,000 individuals and has garnered the support of very important people in the Orthodox community. So it's hard to remember what it was like when we see in Los Angeles the groundbreaking appointment of a president for the Academy of Jewish Religion, an Orthodox woman named Tamar Frankiel. First time in history that a woman is the president of a rabbinical seminary. So the world really has changed. Why has it changed? What was happening in 1972 to make those changes possible? Surely the long history of ordination of women was part of it, but even more important was the second wave of feminism, which taught that the personal was political. Consciousness-raising groups helped many women bring the skills that they had learned in the civil rights movement and the anti-war movement to their own lives and their experience as women. Questions about equality. So I'm going to jump ahead. So back to 1976. In those days, whenever I was invited to speak, it was on the role of women in Judaism. One memorable moment for me was on a radio show where the well-known Jewish host, I won't tell you his name, but you can probably guess it, demanded of me, "What is more important, your Judaism or your feminism?" I paused. And then I asked him, "And what's more important to you, your heart or your liver?" No surprise, I was never invited back on his show. In 1980, leaders of the Women's Rabbinic Network, which was an organization of Reform women rabbis that was founded in 1980, wanted to find out what the reality was, how people perceived women rabbis. So they did this survey, and they collected data that summarized the accumulated fears of congregants, boards, and senior rabbis with regard to hiring women. Among the apprehensions cited were the following. This is 1980, remember where you were in 1980. Here were the fears. A basic fear that women cannot do the job because the rigors of the rabbinate are too great and women are too weak for the demanding routine. Because the Torah is too heavy. Because women are too soft-spoken. Because women do not know how to nor care to wield power or authority. Because women will need to be protected by the board or senior rabbi in confrontational situations. Because women will cry at meetings when pressured or criticized. Because women will create more work for the senior rabbi, because congregants won't want to employ the services of women for certain events. Plus, the senior rabbi won't want to call her late at night in dread of pulling her away from family responsibilities. This is real. I'm not making this up. This is really what people said. A second fear was that women in the rabbinate will not be able to balance a career and a personal life, because the first priority will be to family, and therefore either when female rabbis become pregnant or husbands are transferred, they will leave the congregation. And second, that their work will lead to dissension within their families. A third fear was the fear that women rabbis are too political, too new, too in, too faddy. So, that female rabbis may alienate the more traditional religious and social segments of the congregation. Because female rabbis are feminists only. Because female rabbis wish to attract public attention to themselves. Because female rabbis will give the same sermon on feminism. In towns where the ordination of women in Christianity is an issue, it may not bode well for the Jews to have a female rabbi. Then there was a fear of the unfamiliar, the untoward aesthetic of seeing a woman carrying a Torah or wearing tallit and kippah. And finally, a fear of women succeeding. Women who succeed will reflect poorly on their colleagues. If women can read from Torah, preach, and teach, the rabbi's duties become accessible to everyone. The mystique is lost. The possibility leads to the breakdown of the hierarchy of the rabbi-congregant relationship. So the truth is that last one is true. The ordination of women has led to a breakdown of hierarchy between rabbi and congregation. It has reshaped Jewish institutions, particularly the synagogue. With women as clergy, the boundary between clergy and laity begins to break down, and shared leadership does become possible. Lay people become empowered to take responsibility for their own religious life. In my view, this has led to an explosion of interest in adult learning and to changing models of pedagogy to promote more shared learning and more chevruta work. And it's also changed the model of relationships between professionals with more collaboration and less hierarchy. Career patterns are changing as we see more clergy teams in congregations rather than the old model of senior rabbis, associates, and assistants. The breakdown of religious hierarchy has also led to the desire to be a participant instead of a passive observer in prayer. This shift changes the nature of liturgical music. It affects the way we organize prayer experiences and even the way we use sacred space. More and more synagogues, like Temple Emmanuel of Beverly Hills, looks like this one too, have redesigned sanctuaries so that seating is flexible, enabling different kinds of worship experiences where people can see the face of God in the faces of other people by praying in the round with participants facing each other. In this sense, the movement towards synagogue transformation in some ways is an outgrowth of Jewish feminism. It's led to a more inclusive Judaism and to more openness about spirituality. It's also led to new understandings of life cycle rituals as we celebrate the truth that divinity is present at every moment. We can celebrate that through blessings and ceremonies that honor the Torah of our lives, as well as the Torah of tradition. All of this began with the creation of life cycle rituals for women. Rituals for bringing a girl into the covenant. The first one was 1972. Rituals for when a girl first gets her period. Rituals for menopause. Rituals for weaning. Rituals for miscarriage and abortion. And what we learned from the feminist movement then, we're learning again now. As we notice a new life stage, the stage between midlife and frail old age. The baby boomer generation is entering this stage now, and with it comes a new interest in rituals to mark new transitions, retirement, moving out of a family home, becoming a grandparent, removing a wedding ring after the death of a spouse, finding a way to move on even as one cares for a beloved spouse with dementia. What's changed is that our male colleagues have joined in this liturgical creativity. Once those rituals were only photocopied and circulated among friends, now they're shared online and they're also published in rabbis' manuals. What began in the early 70s as a movement focused on women's equality has also led to the transformation of Jewish theology and prayer. Once it became clear that women could be counted in a minyan, the next question was, how do women pray? Are talit and tefillin prayer clothes of Jews who pray, or just of Jewish men? This question continues to animate the struggle at the Kotel, where women have been, until recently, forbidden to pray in ritual garb. And when we take prayer seriously, the next question is, who is the God we want to speak toward? And how do we find a language in prayer that reflects the complexity of how Jews experience God? Perhaps the resurgence of interest in Jewish mysticism is connected in part to the changes created by Jewish feminism. The legacy of these nice Jewish girls is that feminism is no longer on the margins of Judaism. It has transformed Judaism. Women are part of the story. Gender has become a lens to view all of Jewish experience. The explosion of Jewish feminist scholarship over the past period of time has been breathtaking. Dr., now Rabbi Rachel Adler's book, Engendering Judaism, won the National Jewish Book Award, not in the category of Jewish feminism, but in the category of Jewish theology. The Open Door, edited by Rabbi Sue Elwell and illustrated by Ruth Weisberg, a Reform Haggadah, never uses the word feminist. It doesn't have to. It's the Haggadah of a movement that has been transformed by feminism. It's inclusive, with writings of women and men, of Jews of all different backgrounds and sexual orientation. Feminism's focus on the marginality of women allowed us to notice which other groups have also been marginalized. Gay and lesbian Jews, Jews of color, interfaith families, just to name a few. The contemporary notion of a big Jewish tent is in part the result of this consciousness. And you all know that Women of Reform Judaism published the Torah, a women's commentary, edited by Dr. Tamara Ashkenazi and Rabbi Andrea Weiss. It's used in our synagogues along with the Torah, a modern commentary, edited by Rabbi Gunther Plaut. And it asks questions about the experience of women that Rabbi Plaut never imagined. It's been a long time, more than 40 years, longer than it took us to reach the promised land. Are we there yet? Is the journey over? 20 years ago, we started to ask that question. Then there were still significant differences between the career of men and women rabbis. Women tended to serve in positions as assistant rabbis, campus and hospital chaplains. No women served as senior rabbis of major metropolitan congregations. Some colleagues argued then that women were choosing different paths because they were looking for balance, intimacy, and empowerment in their rabbinate. But others believed that there was a stained glass ceiling. I felt that both were true, and that until we paid attention to the real issues of discrimination against women that still existed, there would never be full equality. Those issues include the significant salary discrepancies between women and men rabbis, the difficulty of counting on adequate maternity leaves, and the reality of sexual harassment and boundary violations. But in the last 20 years, I'm proud to say that the reform movement has confronted the issue of sexual boundary violations. Our movement created an ethics committee that sets tough standards and sanctions, enabling victims to feel safe about reporting rabbis who have transgressed boundaries. Some of those victims have been women rabbis. The old message that our institutions just look the other way has been replaced by a mandate to train rabbis about the devastation caused by sexual harassment and the establishment of a procedure to investigate complaints and monitor disciplinary action. So some things have changed, but some things haven't. Salary inequity, the real difficulty of balancing family life against the demands of a career in the rabbinate. In the larger Jewish world, women are still significantly underrepresented as executive directors and senior managers. Of the top 47 federations across the country, only one is headed by a woman. I could go on. But it's important to point out that we have progressed enough that advancing women's professionals, the catalytic organization that kept these issues front and center in the Jewish community, is handing off the ongoing work of challenging the status quo, empowering women, and creating a new generation of women leaders to a myriad of new organizations that are each doing a piece of the work. So, one of the fears articulated in that 1980 survey was that female rabbis will give the same sermon on feminism over and over again. I confess. I have been given this same sermon for all these years. The Torah portion might be different, but the Nechemta, the comforting conclusion, is the same. When women's voices are around the page, and when women are at the table, the entire Jewish conversation is richer, more inclusive, more meaningful, more accessible, and more real. And I am grateful for all those nice Jewish girls who paved the way.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.